So what's the real reason for the Second Amendment?
And to organize themselves in groups to basically aggressive control.
Control of whom? That's Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz. She tells us who the Second Amendment was designed to control. We talk with her about her new book, Loaded, A Disarming History of the Second Amendment. Then we talk with journalist Greg Levine about his special investigation into the deaths and illnesses afflicting U.S. sailors exposed to radiation from the Fukushima Daiichi meltdown. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. This morning, I stood outside my local high school to show support for the students who were walking out into the freezing cold. They were there to honor the lives of the 17 people killed at Stoneman Douglas High School in Florida and to press lawmakers to pass stricter gun control laws. It was all part of a nationwide protest happening on the one-month anniversary of the mass shooting at Stoneman Douglas. President Trump has already backed off from expressing support for the students' demands, suggesting that teachers arm themselves instead. The NRA is suing the state of Florida for passing what can only be termed a rather tepid gun control law in the wake of the shooting. The NRA claims the law violates the constitutional rights of minors by preventing them from buying assault weapons. Is the right for any individual to buy assault weapons really what our founding fathers were thinking of when they passed the Second Amendment? And why were they so keen on armed civilian militias? My guest, historian Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, has just come out with a book with some surprising answers to those questions. Loaded, A Disarming History of the Second Amendment. Dunbar-Ortiz says, in order to understand the current obstacles to gun control, we have to understand the history of U.S. gun policy, from its role in the settling of America and the early formation of the new nation, and continuing up to the present. Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz grew up in rural Oklahoma, the daughter of a tenant farmer and part Indian mother. She's the author of many books, in addition to Loaded, including An Indigenous People's History of the United States, Roots of Resistance, and Blood on the Border. Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, welcome to Writer's Voice. This book, Loaded, A Disarming Look at the Second Amendment, it certainly has come out at an opportune time.
Well, unfortunately, almost any time it would have come out would have been, you know, very close to one of these mass shootings, not a school shooting, but the one last fall in Las Vegas when I was finishing up the book. And it's just too frequent, you know, so it... But it is, it's been useful in being able to explain some things when people are paying attention.
Yeah, exactly. Now, you point out that we have more than 300 million guns in the U.S., one for every inhabitant. Total gun deaths in the U.S. average around 37,000 a year, which is incredible. And as you point out, mass shootings in the U.S. average more than one per day. Your book, Loaded, tells a story of how we got here, and I think it's very much a story that's unknown by most Americans. You say neither gun rights advocates nor gun control advocates have any idea what the Second Amendment was originally about. So, what was it about?
I should have added there that U.S. historians also fail to acknowledge what it was really about. Although they give confusing explanations and don't even agree with each other, but it has to be seen in the context of what was happening at the time and how normalized violence was since the very first colony was established in 1607 in Jamestown, and the violence was directed at the indigenous people who were farmers. They were fisher people along the coast, but in ancient societies, living in villages all up and down the coast and in that area colonized. So it was settlers coming, settler colonialism, and they come, you know, they immediately attack the native people and they try to take their land. And it's already cultivated land, so they're really appropriating finished land, land that can be worked immediately. So it's not like, you know, they're fighting the sort of image of sort of fighting these hunter-gatherers in the forest who have no concept of land. They're very settled people, in fact, across the continent. That's the case. So it's very traumatic, you know, from day one of the colonization, and that goes on for 150 years before the Declaration of Independence. So in that process, they very quickly, in Massachusetts, 1620, the Pilgrims come. 12 years later, they have formed volunteer citizens patrols, militias, to carry out these brutal killing of civilians, unarmed civilians, because none of these native people were in wars, you know, they were not, they were farmers, you know, so it took a while for them to be able to resist, and when they did, you know, they tried to get that land back, so it was wars, you know, taking place, but the violence was brutal, it was, you know, basically counterinsurgency, attacking civilians, attacking their food supply, burning their crops, burning their storage of food, and driving them out in that way, and killing many of them in the process. You know, the English had already been doing that in Ireland for a century, so this kind of killing civilians and taking their land was already institutionalized, so it was almost a knee-jerk reaction, you know, to behave that way once they came. There had been English traders and Spanish and French off the coast with native people. Their ships would be out and the native people would take items out to trade with the Europeans. So there had been about, you know, 40 years of peaceful trading and interchange. But when, well, it was first 1607 in Jamestown that settlers came that had the intention of, they were contracted. These were all stockholding corporations that recruited these settlers. And the ones they brought to Virginia were very brutal. They wanted to raise tobacco. They knew the tobacco had become an expensive product in Europe, and it was, you know, it originated in North America, the tobacco. Not like we know it today, but, you know, it got more and more refined. But they wanted to make it into a commercial crop to export and to get into that market that the Spanish and Portuguese had already exploited as well. So they decided to take the land and become planters, and then that became the way that 13 colonies were settled. So these militias, you know, developed in each of those colonizing, and they didn't just then take the land and stay there. They tried to expand all the time because they would wear the land out. It was very rich land, but with a monocrop commercial production and not leaving the land fallow as the native people had, and letting it refurbish its nutrients and everything for food crops, and also planting those in relation to each other, the food crops, so that they nourish each other, it just wears the land out. So then they would want to abandon that land and take more land, richer land, either that or expand their plantations. So it was constant warfare for 150 years, not a minute without warring on the native people all up and down the colonies. And then in the 1670s, they had brought black and white people as indentured servants on contracts, but they gradually were developing a racial code of slavery. So by the 1670s, this racial code of all black people were could be enslaved was in place. And then they started using these militias also for slave patrols and controlling slave patrols. And that's really the genealogy of present-day police forces, the practices of the slave patrol. So that's why you have so many killing of especially young black men.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with historian Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz about her new book, Loaded. So you're really saying that the roots of the Second Amendment lie very much in the dual atrocities by which this country was founded: settler colonialism, the expropriation and slaughter of Native Americans, and slavery. Bring us to the War of Independence. It wasn't just about taxation without representation. It had to do with the British policy of keeping the settlers from expanding into Indian territory.
Right. They had had this really vicious 7-year war with France over continental problems, but also fought out in North America because France was in the Great Lakes area and all the way down to Louisiana and up to Montreal, but not settler colonialism. They were doing fur trading. And they claimed, you know, they all of them, these kings, their crowns, they claimed whole swaths of populated land that they had no right to, but it had become a law under the Holy Roman Empire with a papal bull in the 15th century with the Columbus voyage that they had the right. Christian monarchs, they were all monarchs then, had the right to go anywhere in the non-Christian world and take the land and own all the people there and do with them what they wanted. So, you know, to them, they were claiming it. They were there so that it was theirs. And the French did settler colonialism in other parts of the world, but there, I mean, it's not that they were nicer colonizers. And in fact, that kind of colonialism did rope the native people into things that were not a part of their culture, and that is, you know, the fur hunting. They were really trying to transform it into a proletarian force to bring in the skins, you know, and the more they became indebted, say, to the French forts, the more skins they had to bring in. And this was all over and up into Canada. So on the other hand, their land wasn't taken. They had their land. They had their crops, their farming. So their basic culture could remain intact and their lives could be normal and not violent. But Britain won that war and actually won all the French territory, almost all the French territory. But the British drew a proclamation line after that between the colonies, the English colonies, and the Appalachian and Allegheny mountain chain, that no Anglo settler could go over there into Indian country. It was going to remain Indian country. They weren't going to colonize it any farther. And the French weren't either. They were just trading that this was it, you know, and that any Anglo settlers, British settlers who had gone over there illegal, you know, before and remained had to come back. So they actually sent forces in there, you know, to go and round them up and bring them back, because they didn't want, Britain didn't want any more wars with France or with native people. And they had their own interests. They had begun colonizing Southern Asia, India, and they weren't as interested in these colonies. They were still very lucrative, you know, with the plantation, all these trade goods and cotton and indigo, flax, you know, fiber products and tobacco, sugar were, you know, very valuable commodities, and it enriched these British planters. But much greater riches could be found, you know, and they didn't leave the colonies. They simply stopped them there. The colonists had taken on, you know, as settlers, their own societies. And after several generations, people were born there and they didn't know anything else and had thought they had the right to it. And because the kind of commercial agriculture they wanted to expand, and they were already going over that mountain chain and continued doing it after the proclamation line. So a lot of the Declaration of Independence, there's things in there that don't make much sense to people now unless they realize that part of it, because it's about billeting British soldiers and having them come into their homes and confiscate their property to house their soldiers, to clothe them. So they imposed, the British imposed a Stamp Act to pay for that. And it came out of the colony. It was a tax on the colonists on any printed matter and all. And this was their taxation without representation related to the Stamp Act. And we learned that in the second grade, but we don't really know what the Stamp Act was, what the money was to be used for.
So now bring us to the Second Amendment. There was a Declaration of Independence, and then there was the Constitution, and then the Second Amendment. I've heard that the Second Amendment was about making sure that white citizens were armed and organized into militias to furnish slave patrols and fight Indians.
Yeah, and the Second Amendment was when the colonies declared independence. They declared independence, each 13 colonies, as 13 independent nation states. And the Constitution was, 7 years later, which brought together a federal system that would supposedly loosely connect all of these. So the Constitution was really about the powers of the federal government, the powers of the state, the division of powers in the federal government, interstate commerce, all of these things about structure, but it wasn't about people, it wasn't about people's rights. So the 10 amendments were added as individual rights. And these already existed in the separate state. Each of those states made their own constitutions in 1776. And most of them, not all of them, but notably Virginia, had provisions for militias and the right to bear arms based on the continuation of these practices already going on. So they, without any debate, no documented debate or discussion or anything else, it was simply transported in the language we know it as now into the federal 10 amendments, the rights of men, individual rights. So a lot of people want to argue that these referred to, because they has the term well-regulated, but these citizens' militias who organized themselves, and they were not paid by anyone from the outside, they self-organized in their own interests. They were quite regulated within themselves, So it says that in order not to refer just to some, gang of bandits or something that would have this right. And they, a lot of people think that means it's like what the National Guard is today. And so it's, it's obsolete. But what became the National Guard, the so-called state militias that already existed in the colonies, that were, governmental, this was already provided for in the Constitution. The Army was founded in the Constitution, and the state militias, which became the National Guard later on. So there was no need to have that in the amendment if it was a collective government measure. It would make no sense at all. So people who argue that, a lot of politicians, but even some constitutional scholars and historians make that argument, and sometimes I wonder, have they read the Constitution? these things are already provided for.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking about the history of the Second Amendment with Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz. Her new book is Loaded. So let me get this clear. You're saying the Second Amendment really does guarantee the individual right to bear arms?
Right, and to organize themselves in groups to basically aggressive control.
See, that's a link I think a lot of people miss, that it's not just about the right to bear individual arms. It's about the individual's right to create these citizens' militias that will enforce social control on Native Americans and Black people.
Yes, and there, the example that you can go through is, you know, the slave patrols. When the Civil War came, they continued, you know, throughout the Civil War. I mean, they didn't have as much control because, you know, a lot of enslaved Africans were able to escape and go to the Northern troops, you know, join the Union Army. So it was kind of chaotic. But they tried, you know, to continue the slave patrols. But then after the end of the Civil War, 6 months afterwards, voluntary militias had organized all over the South, illegal, under United States Army occupation. It was illegal, and that was the Ku Klux Klan. And then when Reconstruction, when the Army pulled out prematurely, it made Reconstruction collapse because these people were already organized, and these Klansmen simply took off their hoods and their garb and became the police and the sheriffs. So there's, you know, there's this kind of clueless history of the Klan. Well, suddenly they didn't exist anymore, as if, but what existed was a clamped down Jim Crow, you know, and these were the police and the sheriffs. Because the United States Army and the North had hands off. They decided on reconciliation and let things go back like they were without legal slavery, but there was still convict labor, prison labor, indebtedness, all, you know, just a kind of slavery without the institution, but under their own laws, legal. So that's how you can trace a lot of these white nationalist groups. You saw the Klan arising again in during World War One, as basically to attack foreign-born people, immigrants, and more immigrants who were not just Germanic or English, were coming from Southern Europe, Italy, and Greece. And so they were organized against this foreign-born. And many of the socialists, industrial workers, that's why they came to work in industry in the North, were also socialists and had been socialists in their own country. So there was a big socialist movement, a big labor movement. So the Klan reorganized for that purpose. Jim Crow was still in effect. But it wasn't, you know, and when you got to 1950, or really 1940, you had a complete white republic. Everything locked down. Jim Crow in the South, total control of Black people, a diaspora from the South happened to northern cities to work and to escape Jim Crow, but they were still ghettoized, and the police became pretty much like they were in the South, controlling the Black population, segregated housing, job discrimination, where they could only do the, you know, not the well-paid work or the union jobs or whatever. And then with the defense industry, or the war, it was still called the Department of War, the war industry for Second World War, much more of a diaspora even to Los Angeles and to Oakland. So you also had the ghettoization there and the police forces becoming very much like slave patrols in those two cities, which has followed us to today. So everything was locked down, though, in 1940. Native Americans were all confined to reservations, or they were scattered, you know, into for jobs into different cities around the country. They had not much connection among each other, although there was a beginning of a kind of civil rights movement among Native Americans during that period when the Black civil rights movement was just beginning. And there had been, you know, an intellectual class of African Americans, W.B. Du Bois, and a few lawyers. He was a lawyer and a historian with a PhD. And he had formed the NAACP in 1901. So, you know, it was a long history of struggle, but they were in the North, you know. They really couldn't crack the South. But they were studying the situation. What kind of legislation or laws could they get through or get to the Supreme Court to break this down? So they had this great victory in 1954 with the Supreme Court desegregation decision, Brown versus Board of Education. And this was a really traumatic event for the White Republic. It was really like a bolt of lightning. And very quickly, a lot of very wealthy white men in Orange County, is famously kind of the birthing place of this. California actually used to be a very Republican state. They formed the John Birch Society, and among the charter members was Fred Koch of the Koch Industries in Wichita, Kansas, still with us, you know, on the right wing. And Welch himself, who was the main founder, was the heir of the Welch Candy Company. And a lot of men, white men from the oil and gas industry, the war, the defense industry, which was still, became huge in World War II and continued to be huge with the competition with the Soviet Union, the arms race. And these were very wealthy men. They spawned a militia. They called themselves the Minutemen, who were actually crushed by the FBI at the time. But the John Birch Society continued on, and they created a way of organizing. And for wealthy people, it wasn't just money. They actually won a lot of hearts and minds of ordinary white working class people and just white people, white collar white people. And it started in Orange County, but it spread across the country of what they call the kitchen table organizing, kitchen table democracy. So they would have, engage women in this, for women to sit and write letters to their congressmen, letters to their local, and take over school boards. And, by 1970, they controlled a lot of school boards throughout the country. Of course, in the South, they had never, controlled them all anyway, but in the North, and started in California. So that right-wing movement, you saw it kind of pop up with the Barry Goldwater campaign. And in California, Ronald Reagan very much, was friendly with the John Birchers. I don't know if he was a member, formal member or not, but he was an anti-labor person. And he came to power as the governor of California for 8 years. So this was a great right-wing victory, getting Ronald Reagan into office.
That's Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz talking about her new book, Loaded, A Disarming Look at the Second Amendment. We'll talk more after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking about how the Second Amendment came about with historian Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz. Just before the break, our guest was talking about the Second Amendment Foundation, founded by Fred Koch, father of the Koch brothers, along with other wealthy right-wing extremists, to promote the Second Amendment as an ideological force in America. So what is the link between the development of these right-wing movements that are with us today and have captured our government in many ways, and the emerging gun rights movement?
Well, in 1974, a very evil man named Harlan Carter, who had been a vicious border agent, he retired early, probably under force, because they were pretty brutal to Mexicans anyway, but he went beyond the call of duty and killed quite a few Mexicans without any reason whatsoever, cause, unarmed, just migrants, and was never tried or punished for it. But he was from the state of Washington up in the northeast, which is a real hotbed still today of this activity of these militias. And he started an organization called the Second Amendment Foundation. And right away they had their eye on the NRA. The NRA was definitely a gun fetish club of a few collectors. You know, it was mostly rich white men. It kind of started with out of Theodore Roosevelt's Boone and Crockett shooting club. You know, very elite in New York. And so it was kind of an elite thing. It was recreational shooting, you know, and trading guns. It was, I mean, there were a lot of guns around, and there was a whole, you know, the gun industry really used a lot of advertising to convince families, you know, how advertising that took off in the 1920s, that families should, white families that they were targeting, buy their boy, you know, every boy should have a gun. So they had all these pictures and advertisements for that. So that kind of culture took on, but it already existed in the 19th century too. There was, you know, there was this fetish of guns, but as I say, it was so locked down as a white republic that it was just taken for granted. There was no legislation about the Second Amendment. There were, you know, no court cases. There was no opposition. There was no looking at it and saying, should we do this or what does it mean? Or because they had all the rights. White men had all the rights. They still did by 1940. So it was only with this, what they saw was a writing on the wall, you know, that 20% of the population couldn't continue to be, you know, live as in quasi-slavery. And this, of course, you know, the civil rights movement also inspired Native American, Red Power movement, Puerto Rican independence, Chicano, Mexican.
The women's movement.
I know, a huge women's movement, gay and lesbian. So, you know, it kept piling on the right, and then the evangelicals came into that when the so-called social issues became an issue. That was how they folded in the evangelical, which is a huge group of people in the United States, of white people. So they, from the very beginning, the Second Amendment Foundation, had their eyes on the NRA as a pretty well-endowed membership organization in which most of the members didn't participate very actively, because it's sort of like I say, I'm a member of the AAA Auto Club in order to get certain services and road service and stuff, and I pay dues. Well, I get in the mail, you know, my membership voting card, and I throw it in the trash. But there are groups of people who are very active in it, and it's important to them. Well, it's the same with the NRA, but it was a very small number of people who were, you know, the core of it. So it wasn't that hard for them to infiltrate just by becoming members and becoming active. And they took over. In 1977, they took over the NRA and threw out all the gentlemen who were running it, you know, rather casually. They didn't have, you know, any signs before that of the Second Amendment or any of that stuff, but this was the work of the Second Amendment Foundation taking over the NRA and made it into, you know, a white nationalist organization. So today it is the largest openly legal white nationalist organization in the country, and they helped get a president elected, you know.
And gave him $30 million.
Yeah, and it wasn't just that. It's, you know, their politics were more the same. Trump keeps saying he loves the NRA. You know, he has so much money. I doubt that he really needed their contributions, sort of gifts that they give to politicians as an appreciation more than bribes, because they have a mass base, a huge mass base. They do that tabletop, that kitchen table organizing. They're everywhere. They swarm politicians. They go out and put their volunteer. They're not paid for it, you know, the grassroots membership. So the white nationalists aren't just, you know, organizations kind of detached. They have a mass base. And I suppose because I come from rural Oklahoma, I'm so familiar with this, you know, and it's a given that this is the case of probably a good 30% of Oklahomans, you know, including some of my relatives. And, you know, the gun culture comes with it. So there has been an increase in guns, you know, about double, but it was pretty much the biggest in the world even before that, you know, from the very beginning, because guns were a part of, well, as Alan Simpson puts it, there would be no West without the Winchester, you know, that it was cowboys and Indians for real, and wars, you know, really constant counterinsurgent wars against Caribbean island people and Central America and out in the Pacific. And
Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, you do a very effective job in this book, Loaded, of laying out the connections between our homegrown gun culture and U.S. imperialism. But I want to ask you, in the time that we have left, given this mass base you're talking about, and given how captured our Congress is by the NRA, where do we go from here? What are the key lessons of your book that point the way forward to making our communities safer?
Well, I think there's so much denial in the intellectual classes, political classes, you know, the just in general in the white population, especially better off white population, that rationalize arguments that, or make rational arguments that leave out this culture of violence that's existed from the beginning. And also this counter-revolution, you know, again, that racism is at the very core, white supremacy is at the very core of the whole Reagan administration, which even the Democrats, you know, praise Reagan all the time. Obama praised him. There's this insistence or wish that this is a normal country, even though they say it's exceptional. But it is exceptional, but in a different way than they mean, you know, as the greatest place on earth. So it's deep, deep in the culture. And I think especially people who don't come from the, you know, are not descendants of the old settler class, which I am on my father's side, Scots-Irish settlers, the losers of the frontier, I call them, because they kept moving across and, you know, losing any land they got and never owned slaves, but not because they didn't want to. That's the, you know, the poor white population. My dad was a tenant farmer. His dad had had land but lost it, so my dad was a tenant farmer. And I'm not in touch with this history in any personal way. You know, they buy, you know, this sort of scrubbed, you could say whitewashed history of this, what they will admit now, flawed founding, you know, flawed people. Yeah, they were slave owners. They were very wealthy men. They were land speculators. We'll give you all that, but they did something miraculous. They wrote this document that is the most amazing thing in human history, and that we still abide by. You know, that's sanctifying an instrument that should be flexible. No other country in the world considers its constitution a sacred document. So this comes from, you know, the Puritan Calvinist, the word, you know, being that important, that covenant they made with each other. Britain doesn't have a constitution. A lot of countries have constitutions, and many have many, like the French. They, almost every generation, they create a new constitution. They make it a lot easier. It's made in that constitution, they built into it all these trapdoors, so it's almost impossible to even amend it, much less rewrite it. That's not even called for. And even if it's amendment, it has so many things in it that are, you know, structure white supremacy, like the electoral system, that, you know, it would take really doing a whole new constitution. And what that means is a consciousness. So I work mostly with, you know, young people. Young people are, they know something's wrong, you know, that many things happen, people pouring their hearts out in the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement, the women's movement, and all these things hit a wall, you know. So something must be wrong because things get worse and worse and worse. And so until it's apocalyptic, you know, the destruction of the earth itself, the apocalypse of climate catastrophe and possible nuclear war. And then a person like, I think people really awakened when Trump was elected that this is unacceptable. People were in denial. I felt sure he was going to win. I told people, you need to take this seriously because this man has in this kind of system, you know, that's set up a very organized small group, and I mean 1,000, 2,000 people who really work night and day and are dedicated can get someone elected, you know. So we can do that too, you know, but it takes real work, and it takes a fanaticism that's very hard for ordinary people to have, and I think really only fascists have that, and we've got to match it in social justice fanaticism, I think, in order. And that kind of happened in the 60s, you know.
Well, unfortunately, we have to go now. It's a fascinating book, and we've only scratched the surface. It's Loaded, A Disarming History of the Second Amendment. Thanks so much, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, for joining us here on Writer's Voice.
Thank you, Francesca.
Historian Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz. Read an excerpt from Loaded, A Disarming History of the Second Amendment by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, U.S. sailors went on a rescue mission to the crippled Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant in the days after the Japanese earthquake and tsunami. Now, many are sick, and some have died from radiation exposure. Find out more after the break. Sunday, March 11th, marked the 7th anniversary of the Japanese earthquake and tsunami. 7 years for a group of U.S. sailors to get sick, and some to die, as a result of their exposure to radiation coming from the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant, devastated by the tsunami. They were part of a rescue mission to that plant in the days following the disaster. Journalist Greg Levine has written an investigative piece for The Nation magazine titled 7 Years On, Sailors Exposed to Fukushima Radiation Seek Their Day in Court. I called him up to ask him what happened.
So it's been 7 years since a lot of sailors in the Seventh Fleet got, depending on where they were, either an early morning or a late night notice to bring their ships to the northeast coast of Japan. And there they engaged in what was called Operation Tamagotchi, Tamagotchi meaning friend or friends in Japanese, where they did a relief and assistance mission to help the victims of the earthquake and the tsunami. But what they did not expect to encounter was the radioactive fallout from the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant, where over the course of the first few days after the earthquake and tsunami, 3 reactor containments ruptured, which filled the air around the area and littered the soil and eventually polluted the water with all kinds of radioactive fallout. As these sailors tell it, they had different experiences, but all realized something was happening, realized there was exposure, but kept working through their mission. And depending on which ship and who they were and where they were, many of these sailors are now experiencing the kinds of diseases we often associate with radiation exposure.
So cancer would be one of them, but there have been some pretty bizarre other illnesses that seem to be pretty clearly connected.
So to listen to the sailors talk, and I spoke to many of them, and to listen to the lawyers who are now representing them, it does seem very clearly connected. It remains to be determined in court because, like many things related to health and disease, a direct one-to-one correlation isn't always absolutely provable, but there's a preponderance of evidence. And what you see are different stages depending on the level of exposure and the amount of time that passed. Cancers do eventually emerge The more severe your exposure, the sooner they possibly emerge. You often see thyroid cancers first because there's a very easy pathway for radioactive iodine, which is a common byproduct of fission, and that gets into the thyroid very easily. So you'll see thyroid cancers, and you'll see more earlier in women and children. But the cells in the body, as the health experts tell me, the cells in the body that replicate fastest tend to show signs of exposure first. So you'll get a lot of stomach problems because we're always shedding the lining of our intestinal tract. I should say intestinal problems. So you'll see a lot of bowel problems very quickly in the early days, and that seems pretty much a universal for everyone I spoke to. That, for instance, the USS Ronald Reagan, which was the aircraft carrier at the center of this group, so many of the sailors and Marines and airmen who are stationed on the ship talk about having to constantly run to the bathroom, and some of them to this day have not had a regular digestive process and are still experiencing the kind of gastric distress that you would associate with severe gastric diseases like diverticulitis and things like that.
And also some of them, I mean, they're all young, in their 20s, some in their early 20s are experiencing severe arthritis, making them feel like they're 60-year-olds.
Right. So, yes, I spoke to people who were from their, from like 19 at the time through their 40s, but they're all young and healthy. And important to note that in order to start their service, they all had physicals and were deemed in good shape. And yes, you see degenerative bone and joint diseases that are often related to radioactive exposure, radiation exposure, because of other heavy metals that sort of mimic calcium. Strontium-90, for instance, mimics calcium in the body and can cause very brittle bones or brittle teeth. And degenerative discs is a problem. One Marine I spoke to has leukemia, and he is constantly, or he's in remission now, but he still suffers from all the cramping and the joint problems that came on with the disease. There's a host of diseases, and it's widespread, and based on what I'm told by a lot of the radiation health experts, we're just seeing the tip of the iceberg, because as radiation exposure goes, it's pretty early on, even though it's 7 years now. In the next 20 years, you should see a lot more based on the sort of exposures we feel like from the testimony these sailors got.
So these sailors went out for a rescue mission. Were they issued personal protective equipment? Were they told what they were going into?
It depends on which ship and what time they got there. But on the whole, they were not adequately briefed or protected based on what I understand to have happened at the Fukushima Daiichi plant and what the sailors told me they went through. Memories differ and experiences differ. It's 7 years later, but when, say, the USS Ronald Reagan first encountered what a lot of the sailors describe as a sort of thick, warm cloud, they were not wearing protective gear. They had not been briefed that they were sailing into an area with high amounts of ionizing radiation. They were later wanded, told to shed their clothes. They filled out forms to be issued iodine tablets, but no one I spoke to has actually ever issued these potassium iodide tablets. And what those are is a sort of preventive measure, because like I said before, iodine enters into the thyroid. Radioactive iodine can cause thyroid cancers. And so one of the sort of preemptive things that you do if you think you're going to be exposed to the kinds of fallout that would come from a uranium fission accident is that you fill up your thyroid with readily available, more benign forms of iodine so that the radioactive iodine doesn't tend to hang out there. So there was like an inkling. Clearly, when they first sailed through the cloud, at least after several minutes or hours, I'm not sure exactly how much, they realized something had happened and they got away from the cloud initially. And then there is honestly some dispute about whether they continued to move away or had to move back, because honestly, it's easier to do the mission, which they were there for, if you're closer to shore. They were flying supplies and relief and help back and forth from the coast of Japan, and you can get a lot more missions in if you're close than you can if you're 100 miles offshore. But if you listen to the sailor stories, you get the sense that they were repeatedly exposed and that the ships that were in the area were quite likely contaminated. They were warned, for instance, on the Reagan not to drink the water from the desalination system for a while. Apparently, they eventually went back to it. But we now know that the Fukushima Daiichi plant contaminated the Pacific Ocean around the Sendai coast up there. And so the Reagan took radioactive contaminated water into its systems. And once it's there, it's quite insidious and very hard to get out.
Well, and you say that about 80% of the radiation went out to sea. Is that correct?
Yeah, according to people who've done the analysis on the area, because of the way the winds were blowing that day, about 80% of what blew out of the containment buildings at Fukushima Daiichi in the first 2 weeks blew out to sea, pretty much right where this chunk of the Seventh Fleet was stationed.
And can you give us a sense of the levels of radiation that they may have been exposed to?
I actually can't, and this is one of the disturbing parts of this story. Measuring radiation is something that can be done and should be done, but often is not done with the kind of specificity and exactitude that is necessary to predict future health risks. It's quite possible that the Navy knows more than I do. A lot of people think that. But all we know is that they were exposed to some amount, that some tests were taken, but I don't have access to the results of those tests. But we don't know if they were necessarily even the right tests. I mean, there are all kinds of ways you can look at people's exposure to ionizing radiation, from simply taking an an air sample and seeing what's there. You can see what wound up on people's clothes. You can pull the air filters from the ship or the helicopters and see what they absorbed. You can also wand very specific areas because, as I mentioned in the story in The Nation, there something called microparticles, which are these hot particles, which are very, very small, 6 to 9 microns large, that if you're only a few feet away, you wouldn't pick up on any scan, but if you're right next to them, or if you ingest them, or if they stay on your skin for any given period of time, could be very, very harmful. And this goes all the way through to blood tests, which we could do to check chromosome damage, but that is, to the best of my knowledge, something that hasn't been done for any of the people who were exposed.
Now, they're filing suit. Some 400 of these sailors have engaged in this suit. Is that correct?
The lawyers tell me that right now there are about 400 in two separate suits that are moving through the courts in the United States, yes.
And what are they accused? First of all, who are they suing, and what are they accusing them of?
So they are suing TEPCO, which is the Tokyo Electric Power Company, which owned and operated the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant in Japan. And they're suing General Electric, who originally designed and built Fukushima Daiichi and had an ongoing maintenance relationship with the plant all the way through the March 2011 quake. They're suing these two companies, most notably for negligence and for obscuring the truth once the accident actually happened. And the negligence stems from warnings that General Electric and TEPCO had from actually before Fukushima Daiichi was built. All kinds of steps were taken to essentially make it cheaper to build and easier to run, but not necessarily safer. There was a natural seawall in the area that they cut down considerably. If they had built this on top of the original sized cliff, the tsunami probably would not have flooded the basement of the plant as it did. There were questions about the containment itself around these cores, and if the station suffered a loss of power accident, as they did in this case, whether it could contain the pressure that builds up. I don't know how much detail you want to get into about what happens to a light water reactor when there's no power to move water through it, but if they're not cooled and cooled constantly, they become unsafe very quickly. And most importantly, back to the case, is that they're suing in the United States court. And right now, that's been the sticking point for years, which is that they're U.S. sailors who were part of a U.S. mission for U.S. military services on United States ships, but TEPCO and General Electric would both like to see these cases handled in Japan because the way these sorts of cases are handled in Japan is much more favorable to the companies than they would be if they were handled in the United States.
And there are 22 of these General Electric, they're called Mark I boiling water reactors in the U.S.
Absolutely. And except for four of them, they're all over 40 years old, which is past their original design lifespan. They're identical, almost in every way, shape, and form, to the ones that eventually lost containment and melted through in Japan. Some of them much, much closer to large cities than Fukushima was to Tokyo.
For example?
For example, we have the Pilgrim plant in Plymouth, Massachusetts on the Cape, which is a quick drive to Boston. We have a plant in Virginia that's not that far from Washington, D.C. We have plants near Milwaukee. We have plants near Chicago that are all closer.
Wow. Well, Greg Levine, this is a terrific investigation that you did for The Nation magazine. It's called 7 Years On, Sailors Exposed to Fukushima Radiation Seek Their Day in Court. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Absolutely. It's been my pleasure.
Go to writersvoice.net for a link to Greg Levine's article in The Nation. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.